Hello and welcome to the Daily Music Break. I'm Carl. Daily Music Break is at www.dailymusicbreak.com. Please stop by for some great music. We cover music across all eras and genres and free email newsletters. Today we have the pleasure of speaking to Marisa Anderson. Marisa is a guitar player of wide renown. I'm looking really, really, really forward to speaking with her today. How are you, Marisa? How's it going?
Oh, I'm good. Thanks for having me on the show.
Very, very welcome, and we really appreciate it. To start with, can you describe? I mean, I listened to a lot of your stuff, and I read through the biographical and the profile, and I couldn't quite get my arms around describing your guitar playing. How do you describe exactly what you do?
Oh man, I try to avoid describing it. I try to let other people do that. That's why I play.
Okay.
I
can skip to the second question. That's not a problem.
Yeah, I mean, if locked in an elevator with someone, I guess I would say that I use sounds that we already have heard and make new things out of them.
Okay.
Something like that.
Okay. Who are some of the guitar players who you look up to, who you've modeled yourself after or taken bits and pieces of what they do?
Well, I'm a big Doc Watson fan, as well as a Nels Klein fan. I like David Rawlings a lot as far as like people that are still alive. Also, there's an Australian guitar player named Mick Taylor, who I think is fantastic. And then, you know, the usual sort of pantheon of old-timers. Like, I love the Reverend Gary Davis and Son House and Mississippi John Hurt. People like that.
So a lot of the blues people.
Yeah, and a fan of Jorma Kokkonen, of course.
Mm-hmm. When you said Mick Taylor, are you talking about the Mick Taylor who played with the Stones?
No, a different guy.
Different guy. Okay, so there's two great guitar players named Mick Taylor, I guess. Well, one of the first things that I heard that really struck, one of my real favorite songs growing up, was Hesitation Blues, and the version that I was exposed to, like a lot of people my age, was the acoustic Hatuna version by Jorma. And you did something a little bit different with Hesitation Blues. Could you describe what you do with it a little bit, please?
Yeah, I mean, I learned that song. It was one of the very first blues songs that I ever learned, and it took me a long time to. It was sort of how I learned how to syncopate and how I learned how to do the thumb thing. And it took me a long time to learn it. And when I did, I could not let go. And so I just played it all the time. And around that time, I was transitioning from playing classical guitar to playing every other thing out there besides classical guitar. I was like 17, 18 years old. And I sort of discovered the Reverend Gary Davis around that time. And I really couldn't figure out why he wasn't as, like, examined and influential as some of these classical guys that I'd been studying. And so when I went to the Hesitation, which I learned it from his playing, I deconstructed it in a more, in a way that you might do classically, and then built it back up and then threw his legs back in there.
What do you mean by
idea of playing with the idea of, like, what is proper guitar playing in a way? You know, because the guitar was not considered an instrument until only about 100 years ago. Like, not worth to study.
When you say deconstructing it, what I can kind of get an idea from the context of what you're saying, but what does that really
mean? Like, lick by lick, and then I discarded some of the licks and then used other ones, and then also threw in some stuff from other things that Reverend Gary Davis would do. Like, he would often do these kind of high, bouncy lines that he would echo with his voice, and I wanted to throw some of that in there as well. So I pulled things from other songs and put them in.
Really?
Yeah, I just stayed true to, like, a central part of, one or two of the riffs, and then built out from there and built a new song.
And you were bolting on other things that he would do in other songs, and you were putting it together.
Yeah, wow. And then just some things of my own too.
Mm-hmm. And what's particularly compelling about Reverend Gary Davis for you as opposed to the other people? Why do you think? I'm sure it's not better, but what distinguishes Gary Davis for you?
I think his rhythmic sense. And he has, like, multiple harmonic lines going at the same time. Some of them implied that I really love a lot. And then the other thing is just when I was exposed to him was really formative, so I went really deep with him in a way that,
right.
You know, I might have, whoever I've come across, but it was, like, a particular time and place, and so, yeah, mm-hmm. It kind of went there. But his playing is really complex and then also very simple. Like, the ideas expressed are really clear and accessible, but the playing itself is much more difficult than it sounds.
Mm-hmm. You put out, and I don't know if it was an EP or exactly what it was, but I saw it on your website where you play with Elizabeth, play with Elizabeth Cotton, but you share sides with Elizabeth Cotton. It would be a real star if you were playing with her, I guess. What about Elizabeth Cotton? I understand that, you know, and you've forgotten more about this stuff than I'll ever know, but she was a ragtime guitar player. Could you describe that?
I don't think she was really, like, typically ragtime, but she has a bounce to her playing, and she played left-handed upside down, which means that her thumb was playing the treble strings and her fingers were playing the bass strings, which is why she has so hard to imitate her. Well, you can't imitate her. You know, she was playing the guitar basically upside down. And so that's part of why she could get the bounce that she got.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the way that recording, or it's a 7-inch LP, or not an LP, a 7-inch record, and it happened because there's a radio station in Portland, Oregon, where I live, that came across some lost recordings of hers and wanted to put them out, and they put me on the B-side. So I didn't put those out, but I was asked to be on that, which mm-hmm. is a great honor.
Well, sure it was. And my understanding is that she was actually discovered by Pete Seeger's family.
She worked in the Seeger household, I think as a nanny. I'm not sure. And she didn't play much because I think she stopped playing for a while because of religious reasons. That maybe in the context of the household, she would play or, you know, something like that. So, yeah, and then they started presenting her out. Yes.
That's pretty amazing that someone who became so renowned just by coincidence was in the Seeger household. I guess it wouldn't have happened maybe if she hadn't ended up working for the Seegers, but it's kind of quite a story, really.
Yeah, well, it kind of makes you wonder how many people out in the world in those years had great talent but were, you know, denied access, basically, to an audience for it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's a very good... I'm sorry to interrupt you. That's a very good point. I forgot to ask you at the beginning, Marisa, could you tell us where to find your music? It's usually something I do by rote at the beginning of these podcasts, and I forgot. So can you please tell people where they can find some of your music to listen to and to perhaps buy?
Yeah. My website is marisaandersonmusic.com, and my name is spelled MarisaAnderson, and music.
Okay.
And I like music.
Great. You also... you play public domain songs. I read that about you. Could you describe what that is and why you do it?
Yeah. So public domain songs are basically what we might think of as traditional songs. They're songs that are not owned by a publishing company. They are, you know, the resource of everyone. That no one gets to own them, and no one's making money off them. So it's all the folk songs, but also it's, interestingly enough, like Stephen Foster songs are in the public domain. It just matters that no one pays the licensing to like keep them up or deal like that. And I did a record last year that was all public domain songs. And the reason I did it was twofold. One was that I was the artist in residence at the community radio station, and that you know, community radio is also owned by everybody. And so my project as the artist in residence, I wanted to do something that reflected the philosophy of community radio and public radio. Mm-hmm. And so I thought to do that, I've been wanting to do it for a while, make this record of songs that are everyone's. Just in a way, I think I was giving away my sources. You know, that record is sort of the material that I make music out of. So,
right.
Those tones and those songs are my, you know, that's where I go fishing.
Right.
And so I kind of wanted to like get back to that and kind of elucidate that part of, you know, why I even make music.
It's a real Americana, I'm sure. It's a trip down to the core of what America is when you start getting into those old songs that are, you know, just, you know, I guess the way I would say is the core of America, it would sound like to me.
Well, really, a lot of those songs come from Europe in a changed form, and that is, I find that really interesting, the migration of songs and the, mm-hmm. the way that the songs, you know, like, the Scotch and Irish people that settled in the Appalachians, and then how that was influenced by people that were there, and then people that came from Africa, and what that made. And those songs themselves can be traced back to, you know, Ireland and England and Italy and everywhere that people came from. And so, yeah, if you're talking about the core of America, I guess you're talking about, you know, a lot of different people from a lot of places.
Right. Fascinating. Another interesting thing I read about you, Maurice, is that you've walked across the United States a couple of times. Could you, not something you do. You don't just leave your house and decide to walk to, you know, the East Coast, I guess. But well, tell me, please, what you did and why you did it and what that was like for you.
Well, the first walk that I was on was in 1990, and it was from California to New York, Los Angeles to New York, and the walk was to talk about environmental issues, you know, mm-hmm. along the way. It takes 9 months to walk across the country if you walk 15 to 20 miles a day, and we mostly slept outside or in community centers or in churches, so we would talk to a lot of people and meet a lot of people. And then the second walk that I was on went from New York to Nevada, and that walk was in 1992, and it was to bring some awareness to 500 years of colonialism, really, depending on how you look at it. But it was a walk to sort of engage in a conversation about maybe the other side of, you know, this idea that Columbus discovered America. There's more stories than that. And it was also to tie in the to tie in the nuclear industry with the rights of indigenous people, because almost all of the activity that happens in the nuclear industry worldwide happens on indigenous people's land, like testing and development and burial and stuff. So that's what that walk was about, in a nutshell.
Do you see yourself more as an activist or a musician, or are the two wrapped up all in the same thing, or do you just not think about it that way at all?
These days I see myself as a musician with some strong opinions.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is it as physically demanding to walk across the United States as it sounds?
Yeah, it is.
But you don't have to take your shoes off at the airport, though, right?
No, that's true.
That's one way to avoid taking your shoes off at the airport.
If you're not in a hurry, it's a good way to go.
Yeah, that's taking not in a hurry to a fault, I guess. Did the walks influence your musicianship? Did they do anything to how you think about music or how you play it?
Well, in a really sort of logistical sense, there's no electricity, and you're outside almost all the time. So a lot of music is happening on acoustic instruments, And there was a lot of singing. There was a lot of cooking and singing. And I think that was mm-hmm. the biggest thing that I got from because it was in those walks were in a community of people. Usually about 100 people were on it at any time. And we'd break into groups for cooking. And the group that I worked with for the cooking and different jobs, we would sing all the time. And so I learned a lot of songs, and I learned what it sounded like to hear and sing harmony and just like the communal and group aspects of music making in a really functional environment, not in a performative environment, which
right.
I still am really attracted and align myself on the side of functional music, like music for dancing or music for praying or music for, you know, making an environment that is for everyone and not just like the person on the stage.
Right.
You know, well, showing what they do.
Right.
And well, look at work songs. It's almost like full circle. Exactly. Work songs mm-hmm. became entertainment songs, and now you're taking them back to being work songs in a sense.
Yeah, exactly. Like
mm-hmm. Now, my understanding is, I might be wrong about this, that you don't sing. You're a instrumentalist. Is that accurate?
In performance, generally, I don't sing. I love to sing. I love to sing for fun, and I
right.
don't find the performance of singing very fun. So, and I always love to play guitar, and I can do it in front of people or by myself, and it's equally as enjoyable. But singing is something I like to do with people,
mm-hmm.
not for them,
mm-hmm.
in general.
You have the one instrument I saw. I don't have it in front of me. I'm nervously watching the software to hopefully assure myself that we're actually recording this. But you have very interesting looking guitar. It's almost, you know, I might have this really wrong, but it almost looks like a rock or a big, you know, almost like a shoebox. Do you know what I'm talking about? Which instrument that you use pretty
often? Are you thinking about the lap steel?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, so it's just a little lap steel, just a string instrument that I have tuned to open G, or open D. And, it has like this kind of mother of toilet seat
right.
Cover on it. It's kind of, but, I play it with a slide, like a bar. Kind of. It's somewhere between a pedal steel and a guitar because it doesn't have any pedals and it's not on a table, but you sort of lay it flat and play it. Yep. Or it's like an electric dobro, maybe. Think of it that way, too.
Is it my imagination? I'm not a musician at all, but is that a fairly unique instrument other than, you know, it looks unique, but is that a common instrument you're playing there, or is it a little bit of a odd variation?
It is not that uncommon, but mostly people use it very differently than I use it. So the way that I play it and the sounds that I get out of it are very unusual for that instrument. There's a lot of them around. Like you'll see them often kind of collecting dust at music stores because lots of people aren't really sure what to do with them. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, I have a few and they all sound different and I love them. They're mm-hmm. really fun to play.
The dobros, I mean, you said it's almost, you know, dobro-ish. The dobro is one of the most beautiful sounds going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Now, you're off to Europe in a few days?
Yes, on Friday I'll be headed to Europe. I'm going to be on tour there for a month, opening for Sharon Van Etten.
Marisa, this has been great. I appreciate you taking time out. And since I was so lax in the beginning by not asking you where people can learn more about you, could you repeat that, please? And
for my website is marisaandersonmusic.com, and that's MarisaAnderson music.
Beautiful.
I'd like to thank you very much for taking time out. I enjoyed it very much. I wish you best of luck on your tour.
Thanks, Kyle. My pleasure.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye. This has been Carl Weinschenk for the Daily Music Break at www.dailymusicbreak.com. Please stop by for great music across all eras and genres and for free email newsletters. Thank you very much, everybody. Bye-bye.